Design patents have a particular purpose, and when the client understands what they're getting and when they're getting them for the right purpose and when they're using them the way that they're sort of intended to be used, I think they can be very powerful.
Hello, I'm Bruce Berman, the host of Understanding IP Matters, a podcast series that looks at the impact of intellectual property rights on people and business. Season 3 spotlights such topics as artificial intelligence, IP licensing, and TikTok as a learning tool. Enjoy the episode. In the 10 years since the $500 million win for Apple against Samsung for infringing Apple's iPhone rights, design patents have tripled. Design patents are dramatically different from utility patents. The surge in filings is due not only to the increased damages awards, but to the consumer interest in the look of new products and, to some extent, filing activity in China. It is less a matter of either utility patents or design patents, but how they can work together with other IP rights, notably trademarks and trade secrets. To better understand the expanding world of design and IP rights, two experts are with us this morning. One, a leading lawyer in design patent litigation, and another, an IP executive with experience on the business side of design and risk for leading corporations, including Philips and IBM. Elizabeth Farrell, a partner at Finnegan, focuses her law practice on all aspects of design patents, from filing to defense. She counsels clients who hold design patents as well as those accused of infringement. She has experience with design patents related to consumer and industrial products, medical devices, transportation, and construction vehicles, and many kinds of graphical user interface. Ryan Hinman headed IP business and licensing at several leading companies, including Philips, IBM, Verizon, and InterDigital. He has negotiated IP transactions, including those relating to design, in many countries. Currently, he is Chief Innovation Officer at Aon IP Solutions, which focuses on calculating and ensuring IP-related risk. Good morning, Beth and Brian. In my research for this episode, I discovered that you have more in common than an interest in design patents. You both spent part of your career in the Air Force. Beth, tell us about what you did in the Air Force.
Sure. Hi, Bruce. It's nice to be here today. I went to the Air Force Academy, and after I graduated, I became a communications officer in the Air Force. So I unfortunately missed cyber warfare by about 2 years. And so I was doing your more traditional kind of radar systems and telephones and email and all of that sort of stuff. But I really enjoyed my time in the Air Force.
Brian, you flew, I believe.
Yes. Yeah, I flew KC-135, which is an air refueling tanker, basically, and flew over in Desert Storm and had, combat medals and all that kind of stuff. But it was a great experience for me.
For either of you, did that influence your relationship or interest in IP rights?
Well, I don't know if it influenced, but certainly when I came out of the Air Force, it was, I was looking to do something different, getting back to my academic background and stumble across intellectual property. So I wouldn't say it was something that led to it, but it was certainly something that evolved from it.
The idea of working with the patent office doesn't, they have regulations, they have instructions. All of that seems very familiar if you've been in the service.
Design patents, once a relative afterthought, are increasing in record numbers. China in 2020 received 55% of global design patents. To what do you attribute the increased interest? Beth, let's start with you.
Sure. So I would say design patents are important to different stakeholders for different reasons. I would say that some of it is just a sort of increase in public awareness about good design and the value of good design. I think that's one piece of it. But I think there's others. There's situations in which the underlying technology may have stagnated and there's some desire to refresh the product and you can refresh the design of the product. And a lot of companies spend a lot of money in thinking about design and in evaluating which design they're going to pick. And when they've spent that money, they think it's important to protect that investment to keep a competitor from copying or closely mimicking it. I think the other piece that we see is that, and this is a little bit more of kind of a trademark or branding reason, but as companies are trying to market similar products around the world. You know, you always hear these sort of jokes about, oh, the trademark in one country is actually like a vulgar word in another country. And what happens with design, though, is you don't have that problem. Design is design. And so a design can be a certain design in the United States. You can use that same design in another country because it's not language dependent. And for a lot of companies, that can also be another valuable piece.
I think there's probably a number of reasons. I ran into this, and we can get into my personal experience having been my most recent being at Philips when I was chief IP officer there, and really developing and growing a portfolio. And as you mentioned, Bruce, it's not just about design patents. It fits into a whole spectrum of what you're trying to grow holistically in a company to protect your product and innovation. So we call it integrated intellectual asset management approach, where you're looking at design patents as a piece of the puzzle that ultimately fits together to protect those revenue streams. So I think companies are starting to embrace that, as we just discussed, advances in technology, but also increased awareness of the value of design patents because they're relatively affordable. They're quicker compared to utility patents. I think design patents take around 20 months to secure, and utility patents maybe closer to, say, 30 months. And even though the duration is more limited because it's limited to 15 years from when it's granted versus a utility patent generally lasts 20 years. So it's, you know, there are different rules, but generally it has been increasing in popularity.
Are design patents more difficult to defend? That was one of the knocks I'd heard against design patents in the past. But with the big win for Apple, I think that all changed.
Yeah, I think I'll start and, you know, and then we can sort of discuss it. But really, the enforcement of a design patents, I would say, is rather limited because generally, inventors of a design patent, they can stop others from making, using, or selling a product which looks like the patented product. So it doesn't matter if it does the identical thing or the functionality the identical way and achieves the same result, it must look like the patented product. So a patented claim can include, you know, several features, but to avoid patent infringement, your product can't mirror all the same features as those covered by the product claim. So if you add one extra feature, will not prevent the infringement because your product will still include all of the relevant features of the patent claim. So you get into this what's called an ordinary observer test, which is really the standard for determining design patent infringement, basically asking whether the accused design would appear substantially similar to a patented design to the eye of an ordinary observer. You know, a lot of companies talk about design around. Design around is a way to avoid infringement of a design patent. Basically, you need to design a product that achieves the same result but doesn't infringe on the patent holder's claims.
I think that one of the fallacies I find is people spend time comparing the breadth of a utility patent to the breadth of a design patent. They are not the same thing. It's sort of like comparing the breadth of a utility patent to the breadth of a trademark. It might be fun for law professors, but practically speaking, it's not really a useful exercise. Design patents have a particular purpose. And when the client understands what they're getting and when they're getting them for the right purpose and when they're using them the way that they're sort of intended to be used, I think they can be very powerful. I recall a number of years ago, I remember a talk that was given by a gentleman who worked for a shoe company. And he said, oh, we love our design patents. In the last 10 years, I've sent out 600 letters. I've filed 5 complaints. Because people get the letters, they see the problem, and they fix the problem. He said, our design patents are doing what we want them to do. They don't do the same thing a utility patent does, and I don't think they're designed to do that.
Yeah, kind of like a trademark. They dissuade use of the look rather than collecting damages. It's not about collecting damages so much. In recent years, now in 2023, Harrity & Harrity, the law firm, maintains the 100 top design patent recipients, U.S. design patent recipients. And it's interesting to look at the list. Nike, Apple, Masco, Swatch, and Hyundai all up significantly. You know, Nike you would expect. They're pretty aggressive. I think they're number one in design patents. But down, on the other hand, is Samsung, Tata, which owns Jaguar, Ford, and Porsche, significantly down. It's kind of interesting. I wonder if it's year over year. If you had a lot of design patents last year, you might not have so many this year. Or is it a part of a trend?
I would say I don't think it's part of a trend. I think that if you were to expand that to a 5-year period of time, maybe find out that Porsche didn't do a major redesign this particular year.
They may have had an increase last year in 22, so they don't need that many. So it looks like it's down.
Yeah, it's tied to product cycles very much so.
Philips Brian, they're up 95%. Now, they're out of the consumer electronics business, which you would think would be a big area for design patents. So I know you're not involved there anymore, but you might have some awareness. So what are they filing design patents on if they're not doing consumer electronics?
I dealt a lot with design at Philips. Matter of fact, we won a ton of design awards for a lot of the healthcare products that Philips really has morphed into. So as you're correct, they sold off and divested everything in their consumer electronics, but they still have a lot of consumer products like, you know, the Sonicare toothbrush, which has a very unique design. You've got a lot of MRI machines, CAT scans, CT, and all of the like, where there are functional designs, right? So you're dealing a lot with functionality of designs being critical in the healthcare environment. It's critical to really differentiate those products, because they have to meet specific safety and performance standards like the MRI and CT scan machine. So that's where the functionality comes in. And I know that was one of your questions, which is really around the functionality of this. It's true that the fundamental difference between design patents, utility patents, is design patents protect how it looks. Utility patents protect the way it's used and works. So design patents protecting the ornamental characteristics. But when it's functional, when a design's functional, it does what it's expected to do and does it well. So that's what we were trying to get at, because a good design has a purpose and it's crafted in such a way it's going to consistently and reliably execute a particular function. And without the functionality, a design may look good, but it may ultimately fail to meet the needs of the user. And so I think that the notion that aesthetics and functionality are mutually exclusive is really a myth.
I would agree with Brian. One of the challenges, at least in the United States, is that our system is relatively slow. So it does take, you know, there's an expedited process, but it does, as Brian mentioned, take, you know, 20 months, more than a year and a half to get a design patent, which means that there are certain industries that could benefit from design patents. I'm thinking fashion, right? That could benefit from design patents, but it's not necessarily practical for them in many circumstances. The product cycle is fast. Now, setting aside, Lululemon may have a particular design they plan to use for 5 years and they get a patent on it. But what you can see is that a lot of what I would call more mature industries, or industries with slower product cycles, do benefit from design patents. So especially in an area like a medical device, where maybe there isn't a desire to change it every 6 months, in part because that probably introduces, you know, error to the person who's using the device. Once they learn how to use the device, let's maybe keep it that way for a while, right? And so those are areas that definitely can benefit from design patents, because they're not as concerned about the length of time it takes to get them.
The types of companies that receive design patents are surprisingly diverse: automotive, fashion, electronics, appliances. I mean, it's really all over the map. Is this because the products today have become, in many instances, where style and look is more tied to functionality, as Brian had alluded to?
I think it's more that people are getting a better education about what you can use design patents for. So in my mind, there's maybe three reasons. I think there's three big categories for why companies get design patents. I think the first one is they're worried about a straight up counterfeit of their entire product. So that's the idea that Brian suggested about, you know, a replacement toothbrush head. They are worried about a copycat replacement toothbrush head. I think the second is companies that are interested in protecting their replacement part revenue stream. You know, that's something that we can do in the United States. It's a little harder in Europe, but it can be a really valuable thing for the company to maintain that revenue stream. And then the third is where I think you're talking more about the branding idea. You're trying to protect the overall look and feel of the product. And maybe it's not the entire look and feel. So it might be elements of the look and feel. And there, this is a little bit sort of higher end, but at the end, they're looking to try to build trade dress rights in those various little branding pieces. And so that will be where you see sort of like design patents, and people go, well, what the heck is this protecting? Like, it's only protecting part of this thing. Well, that's usually done by design, because there is an attempt to protect that particular hood shape or that particular decorative element on your home appliance, or, you know, whatever it is you're protecting.
And that became, that trade dress was a big issue in the Apple Samsung case, right? Because it was really, the courts felt like not only was there infringement on Apple's design utility patents, but it also had diluted their trade dress related to the iPhone. So it became a very front center issue.
That case, Apple v. Samsung, resulted initially in a $1 billion award. It was cut back to, I think, $500 million, $750 million of which was attributed to design rights. Now, that's unprecedented as far as I know. How surprising an allocation of value was that?
I think it was not surprising, because the case really revolved around a number of design utility patents for the basic functions of a smartphone. So everywhere from the tap to zoom and the home screen app grid. So while it was hashed out using specific patents, the battle was ultimately about whether Samsung copied Apple in the early days of smartphones to really gain an advantage in the marketplace. And ultimately, it was found that that was the case. So even though the verdict came out with such a high amount, it was whittled down to 500, I think it was something like $539 for Apple. You know, Samsung, they appealed, and ultimately they were able to reach an agreement before it could be litigated again. But it was very much, you mentioned the percentage as far as how much is attributed to this. I totally would justify that.
It was an area with high volume products that had high profit margins. But one thing I've always thought was really interesting about the Apple Samsung case was that although that was very heavily litigated and they were very interested in, they were definitely having a long-term fight on that one. Apple and Samsung at the time were each other's biggest customers. And so, and the deals that they were making outside of that case were in the billions. So I think it's just almost like a different universe, whereas that seems like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money. But when you were thinking about the smartphone market in general and the relationships, it's not as big a deal as it might seem.
Right. It was almost like an arduous license. You know, they got what they wanted, both sides, in the end. It cost a lot of money, but in that scale, for Samsung, it probably wasn't as much as we think. Where design patents are litigated, it's increasing, obviously. Beth, you would know more about that than anyone. But it seems like the automotive industry has not chosen to use their design patents for enforcement. BMW comes out, like I remember the 7 Series, this is maybe 20 years ago, came out with a very strange look. A lot of folks hated the BMW 7 Series. It had this weird kind of big trunk-like back. And of course, it became extraordinarily popular. Virtually every large size sedan adopted that. Now, I'm not aware of any litigation or fighting over that or licensing. It seems like automotive industry, there's sort of a tacit understanding that we won't go after each other.
I think that automotive companies are primarily getting design patents to deal with the crash parts situation and wanting to control the secondary market for the crash parts. So I don't know that they are as interested in suing each other over, you know, sort of overall in style. And typically the patents that I've seen in this space are not really directed to the overall look and style. They're more directed to a headlight or a bumper or, you know, a very specific part that they probably, at least initially, would like to license to someone to make, and, you know, would like to keep others from making. That's, I think they're just using them for a slightly different purpose than what you maybe suggested.
Yeah, I think it may be difficult because don't forget, you have to mirror all of the same features as those covered by that patent claim. And, you know, in the automotive case, it may be some of the features, but perhaps not all of them. So it may be more difficult, and they recognize the difficulty in being able to enforce that because of that.
There's more activity on the trade dress side for the really iconic car and automotive shapes. So it's one thing if you kind of copy something, a bit of something, but it's another if you get close to the Mustang taillight or you get close to the, you know, Jaguar grill. Like then they start to get much more interested in you staying away from their sort of marquee shapes.
The Aston Martin grill. I'll never forget coming back out of the train to my car in the parking lot. And I look up, I see what I think is an Aston Martin grill. You know, Ford had been using them for years and it looked good on a Ford, but it's not an Aston Martin. And I look up and I say, oh, that is an Aston Martin. I was so surprised to actually see it on the car that originated it.
The other thing to think about, Bruce, is which is relevant, and we'll go back to the Apple Samsung case because it's relevant for automotive, is if you're looking at a headlamp or the design of a different part of the car, you have to, you know, reference Section 289 of the Patent Act, because in Apple Samsung, it became front and center because you're looking at whether or not the relevant article manufacturer for the purpose of calculating damages under that section for the design patent infringement in that case is the entire, in that case, it was the entire smartphone versus a part thereof. And so if it's a headlamp, you know, can you justify it for the cost of the car? So Section 289 provides a damages remedy specific to design patent infringement. And the Supreme Court in that case interpreted it for really for the first time in arriving at a damages order.
Graphical user interface, the look and feel of how users interact with programs and machines, this is a valuable asset that design patents can address. Tell us about the role of design patents in GUIs. Beth?
Yeah, so this is an interesting area. It all started in the mid-90s because there was a, which is now the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, but it was previously a, had a different name, but same function, recognized that it would be possible to protect a graphical user interface under certain circumstances. And that eventually led to the office changing their instructions to the examiners, which grew into this whole big category of patents that kind of didn't exist before. And it was many years until any of this was litigated. So there were lots and lots of design patents that were coming out on GUIs for years. And Apple Samsung was actually the first case that really considered enforcement of a GUI at that level, you know, taking it all the way through the jury. And it's been an interesting area because it's always kind of operated kind of in a quasi-approved space. And there is now some question, and there's been some recent, I guess there was a request for comment, and then I think there was sort of a response from the Patent Office that came out a couple of weeks ago on this topic, where there was a question about whether you could, so part of the legal fiction that was created in the mid-90s was that if the design was on a display screen, then you had an article of manufacture. So under the rules and the statutes in the United States, you need to have an underlying article of manufacture. You can't just have a design that's kind of floating out there in space. Sometimes they call that a per se design. You need it to be applied to an underlying article. And the solution that the Patent Office came up with was, well, we'll apply it to a display screen, which sounds great. Only that was, 30 years ago. And we are now in a world where we have holograms and we have augmented reality and we have virtual reality and we have all sorts of GUIs, which are not necessarily tied to a screen anymore. And this is what the Patent Office originally said they were going to address. To be perfectly honest, I think they kind of sidestepped that in the information that they sent out a couple of weeks ago, because I think they just kind of restated a lot of what they had before. And I don't know whether that means we need a statutory change or exactly what that means moving forward. But we are in a bit of a pickle in the sense that technology is moving forward. And clearly, companies have found GUI patents to be valuable. They're investing in them regularly. And Apple is, and others, they're not the only, but Apple and others are enforcing them. And so you're kind of in a situation where that train is leaving the station. And there's a little bit of a question as to whether the Patent Office is going to figure out a way to get on board. It can be very frustrating to invest money in something and then find out that you've gone to whatever the available IP rights are in your country and are basically told sorry.
The rules are fairly well known for design patents, right? You have to have novelty, originality, ornamentality, as well as article of manufacture, as you mentioned, and, you know, in non-obvious. So it's that whole article of manufacture that kind of scratches my head a little bit as far as how broad you can take that. It'll be interesting to see how that gets interpreted.
Can entrepreneurs and small companies or startups take advantage or make good use of design patents, or is it really for larger companies releasing products?
I think it can be for both. I think the biggest thing that holds up the smaller companies is, and this happens for patents too, is they don't realize about the deadlines for filing after public disclosure. And they also don't realize what public means. That seems to be a big problem. Oh, we only told our investors in a room at our office. I'm like, were they under a non-disclosure agreement? Well, no. Well, then that's the public, right? They think you have to put it on Twitter whatever they're calling it now, or they think you have to put it out on the internet. There can be some misconceptions about patenting in general, design or utility. And then what I find is we catch a lot of people on the second round, right? They go on Shark Tank and then they realize, oh, I should have filed my patent before I did that, right? So, and that's just, I think, an education thing more than anything.
I agree, because I think both sets of constituents are seeing the value. And it gets back to our very first question, which is why is it growing? Because there's the education that's taken place. And I think there's interesting things like AI and image-based searching tools. I think that's going to revolutionize how design patents are evaluated, you know, by the patent office and also enforced, because it'll make it much easier to, or at least facilitate how that's done.
Do design patents publish like utility patents after 18 months?
No, they weren't part of that change in the statute. They remain unpublished until they issue. However, to be fair, at the time that they passed the statute, design patents came out a lot quicker. So they actually would have come out, generally speaking, before the 18-month deadlines. I think that may be, I mean, it's probably lost to history, but I think that's one of the reasons possibly that it wasn't considered necessary.
Now, we've talked about the good parts of design patents, but not everyone agrees. Design patent critics say a major limitation of patents, and we alluded to this a little bit earlier, they cover the look of a product, but not the function. But they're really not supposed to, as we have discussed. But not everyone agrees that design patents are necessary. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, not always a friend to IP rights, called them useless. And I quote, "Because design patents can only protect non-functional works, they're kind of like copyrights for visual works. And the bar for creativity and originality in a patented design is low. So low that even a standard issue graphical user interface can get patent protection, as our latest stupid patent of the month shows." They feel it's unnecessary. Why are they wrong?
Well, like I get back to the notion, you know, you're figuring out it really revolves around functionality, right? So a lot of people have the incorrect notion that, okay, design patents are around the aesthetics and functionality is different and they're mutually exclusive, which I think is a myth, because you really have to good functional design, like, for a good example of a functional design is an ergonomic office chair, right? So it has a great unique design, but it also has a great functional ability. So, and that differentiates itself. So good design has a purpose and is crafted in such a way that it will consistently and reliably execute a particular function. So there is, you know, there's an overlap there and they are not mutually exclusive.
I mean, I think the EFF has an agenda. I think that's pretty clear. And I think that the patent office, while the examiners, I think, are trying their hardest, they are people, and it's an agency of people, and not every design patent that comes out is necessarily the greatest. I think the same is true with utility patents as well. And I'm not sure that we should be judged by our narrowest, least inventive patents. I think that if you ask the designers who have products that are protected by design patents, they will tell you, "I worked very hard on coming up with a design to meet this need, and I feel that my work should be protected." And I think that at the end of the day, I mean, there's a lot of sort of technical differences between design patents and between copyrights. They come from different places. There's a different history to them. And there are reasons why in certain circumstances, a copyright is more appropriate or a design patent is more appropriate. But, you know, they don't overlap 100%. And so if you got rid of design patents, there would be a hole in our ability to protect certain things.
District courts grant preliminary injunctions on design patents more frequently in design patent cases than utility patents, for sure. And plaintiffs can obtain a reasonable royalty or even total profits from an infringer, making it a costly threat.
Yeah, I mean, preliminary injunctions are hard to get no matter what, but I think they are available. And in certain circumstances, it is easier for a judge to see the problem. One of the problems we deal with utility patents, right, is we have to go through claim construction, and that's a pretty wonky process. And there's a lot of district judges who feel like they may not do that many patent cases, and they feel like they need more to consider and to deliberate before making a decision. But I think they can see the problem with the design patents. And you see a number of situations where the preliminary injunction issues and then the case settles because maybe somebody didn't think somebody was really going to push this or really go to court. And you said this earlier, Bruce, but I think it bears repeating. I don't think most design patent owners are trying to get damages when they file a lawsuit. They're trying to get you to stop using their design. And you design around it, great. Because then there's a whole bunch of benefits to them for that. And I think that the design patent damages statute to me is more of a warning or a stick to make people pay attention. I don't, because in most situations, you know, even though I have clients who understand how much damages could be received, oftentimes, you know, the patent owner is making a premium product with a premium profit margin. The defendant is usually not doing that. So the defendant's profit margin, while it might seem like a lot of money to the plaintiff, they're saying, all I want them to do is stop. I mean, I don't necessarily, that's a pile of money, but I'm gonna have to spend a lot of money to get that. And I really just want to go back to selling my product.
Yeah, I think that, and that's why another avenue that they can pursue is through the ITC, right? Seeking a Section 337 investigation. So basically that would allow someone to obtain an exclusion order limiting the shipment and selling into the US of an infringing product. So to your point, it's not really about the damages, it's just about stopping the behavior, right?
So a design patent has some of the characteristics of a trademark in a way.
It does. And I find that they're litigated much more like trademarks, much more for sort of trademark type reasons. So what I tell people is you're getting a design patent like a utility patent, but it's much more enforced like a trademark.
It probably shouldn't be called a design patent. It should be called something else, maybe.
Yeah, it's not called a design patent in many parts of the world. It's called a design registration. In some places, it's just called a design. Like they don't try to, they consider it a third column of IP protection, utility, design, and trademark.
We're getting towards the end of our time. How do you see the future? Do you believe there are going to be a higher number of design patents, somewhat more or a lot more? Is China challenging filers outside of China because they're filing so many design patents, then it kind of behooves others to file them? Brian, you've done some work in China.
Yeah, I mean, they're all about, I wouldn't say all about, but certainly it's quantity over quality in China, right? So there's massive, massive filings at the patent office, and whether or not they're ultimately going to be defendable or enforceable is another question, because, you know, that's all up to the courts. But, you know, putting that aside, I think the future does hold exciting changes for design patents. I mentioned earlier, one thing that could really change the game is AI. Really, and image-based searching tools, because the patent office, you know, this 20 months that it takes to get a design patent could, you know, that could shorten depending on how those tools can revolutionize how they're evaluated. And also that could affect enforcement as well. So that could change the tide as far as seeing more enforcement activity to the extent that these tools could be used to do that. So I think it's a bright future. Small companies and large companies are embracing it. I think there is a keen importance of having this as a tool in your tool belt for an integrated approach on how you're looking at your portfolio overall.
Yeah, I would agree with Brian. I think that technology is going to change a lot of things about the design search and design application process, and maybe even about the design formation process, because I've talked to clients who are in some ways thinking about or even sometimes using generative AI to create new designs. And so we're back to the whole issue of, well, if we don't have a person as the designer or the inventor, you know, kind of what we do with that. So I think design will have many of the same issues that utility has. Design will have some of its own issues. Thinking back to the issue with the augmented reality and virtual reality, like I said, I think that's an issue that we're going to have to deal with, because the stakeholders are going to want to protect those ideas. And so I think it's going to be an interesting future. And I don't think 10 years from now, it's going to look much like it does today.
What two points, this final question, would you like to leave listeners with? What should they be thinking about design patents? Brian, we'll start with you.
Yeah. So I think, first of all, don't ignore it as a critical element in your portfolio development strategy. And secondly, think outside the box, right? Innovative designs, combine that with the functionality, right? So think about it as two elements that work very well together, because you have a design that's very ornamental, but think about the functionality of it and how that can be protected. And, you know, as a great tool in your tool shed.
What I prefer is when clients bring us the thing they want to be protected, and then we have a productive conversation about how to go about doing that. Because I think that what you see is people who discount designs, they say, oh, out of hand, well, I don't want a design patent. And I say, really? Because that, along with this other thing, might really help you protect this product that you have. And sort of as a related to that, I think that at the end of the day, if you are going to enforce any of these rights, it is about a story that you can tell the judge, a story that you can tell the jury. And having a few pictures in your story can definitely make it easier for the judge and jury to understand what's going on. So they can be valuable on a number of levels, but it can almost be a a way to get someone's attention. So even if your demand letter, for example, includes some very powerful utility claims, maybe the design patent's the thing you put on the front page to get people's attention.
Well, that's fascinating. Well, thank you. On that note, I think we'll conclude. And thank you both. Understanding IP Matters is brought to you by the Center for IP Understanding, an independent nonprofit. Follow CIPU on LinkedIn at the Center for Intellectual Property. Content conveyed is for informational purposes only and does not represent the views of CIPU or its affiliates. This episode was produced by Jack Shields for Wild Creek Studios.